We're going to talk to Advocate Debbie Ainsley today about deceased estates. I guess we're going to cover both intestate, that is without a will, and deceased estates with a will. So let me hand over to Debbie and say good morning.
Hi, Hank. How are you?
I'm good.
Morbid topic, people will think, until they land themselves up in the situation where they've got to try and sort out monies, and you've got hungry kids, and there's money tied up, then, and where it goes to after a person dies might be morbid, but it might also be absolutely necessary.
Well, I've seen a lot of very bad actions on deceased estates. The loving family pull out their knives as soon as the person has died. But you can talk about that.
Could I correct you and say not so loving family too? Can we include those?
Yeah, that's it's just amazing to me how that happens. We'll cover that, I'm sure.
Okay, where do we want to start?
All right, let's start with a will, okay? Mm-hmm. Someone who has got a decent will. And one of the questions, let me start off with a question. How formal does a will have to be, and where do you sign a will, and what makes it a valid will, and what makes it a will that can be challenged?
Okay, so a will doesn't it's not a formal like template or layout or whatever, but there are certain requirements. Okay, so a will has to be witnessed, and normally by two people, and it has to identify the deceased properly. So I am so-and-so, I live at this place. Even if you move later on, they'll still be able to trace that that's where you were living, so you got the right person. Obviously, it's much easier if you put an ID number in, or a passport number, or something that you're identifiable from the will. And then the witnesses, it's also not required now. The witnesses are required, but it's not required that they be contactable. But if there's going to be a challenge, isn't that a wise thing? So we now, at the end of wills, find that the witnesses' full names, ID numbers, and addresses are also provided, because then they can be traced, even if it's 20 years or 30 years later, to say, did you actually witness this will? It's got to be dated, so it's got to be signed and with a place and a date. And if it's not dated, it can't be enforced without going to court with giving evidence as to when it was signed, because you don't know if it's an earlier or later will. So it's got to be dated. The other thing that people often do is they want to make a change to their will, and they scribble on it, and I've actually known this to have happened in my own family. They write something on it, and in one case, it had witnesses that signed on the manuscript amendment, but no date. And in another location, it had no witnesses, but a date. Both of them were not enforceable, those amendments. And as a result, it actually meant that we had to go back to a previous version, because there was also a page that had been unsigned. So each page also has to be signed at the bottom, or initialed at the bottom, by the person who's writing up the will plus the witnesses. And that way you ensure that no one's inserting an extra page or deleting a removing a page and so on. So that's what we're looking for in a will. The problem comes in, though, is where is that will? So estates are treated as interstate, and then suddenly it's like, oh no, but when we eventually got to the bank account, the bank said, oh, but we've got a will for this person, or an old attorney's office had a will. So you know, friends and family, attorneys, banks, even if you've got big accounts, you know, you can say, look, here's my will. but it's a good idea that is, they don't have to know the content of the will, but they have to know that there is a will, and somewhere there's got to be an actual will. So what we also do with that is wills are often signed in not so not and I was going to say in duplicate, but they're not copied. So you have two original wills of the of exactly the same wording and everything. One sitting at your bank or your attorney, and one sitting in your house. In your file that says "very important stuff. Grab this file in case of fire," or whatever you
Yeah.
want to call it. Yeah.
Now, what's the safe place to keep a will? Because we can imagine that someone who comes across the will and discovers that they are not in the will, they can hide it, tear it up, burn it, and let it disappear. So what's the safe place? A bank?
Well,
Attorney?
firstly, making more than one original, having more than one original is a good idea. Okay, and the answer, the clue to the answer is in the question safe. Keep it in a fireproof safe or whatever at home. But definitely, your bank should know that you have a will and have a copy of it, whether that's an original copy or not, and an attorney, if you've had a long-standing relationship with an attorney. Now, before I studied law, I certainly did not know of a what was that? Who has long-standing relationships with attorneys? But some people
Yeah.
do. So, but your bank is normally a good one to know, to let know about your will. Your spouse, your children, they don't need to know the contents. They need to know that there is a will and where it is. And yeah, account, if you've got an accountant, if you've got, you know, those kind of people that are going to be involved at the time. It's even your if you're church going and there's going to be a funeral, you know, your pastor or priest or minister, whatever, you can say to him, "Look, I've got a will. You know, when I die, they're going to come to you. Can I give you a copy of it?" Whether I wouldn't give him the original, unless you make five originals, him or her. There's some churches let women in. So basically, it's got to be available, and you've got to be able to talk about it.
When you say copies, they have to be original copies or
So,
originally signed.
so, so, what I would suggest that, for example, if you're going to give it with your bank or your accountant, that you have originally signed more than one of at so when you've made the will and it's drawn up and you've got your witnesses there, print out two, at least maybe three or four copies, and then you sign each of those copies, every single person signs again. So those are four originals. And remember, it's dated. So if you ever amend it or add to it or change it, it will it the date shows that this is the old one.
Okay, I'm going to veer off a little from what you might intend, but in the will you will also appoint an executor. And my knowledge or limited knowledge of this is that appointing your bank as an executor, in my view, is not a good idea. And the reason is banks are big, cumbersome organizations and there's no urgency. So a will can take years before it pays out because just because of slow processes at the bank. Am I correct, and is there a better way?
Okay, let's backtrack a little bit on this. The whole process is slow and cumbersome. It takes a long time to wrap up a deceased estate for a number of reasons. Okay, there's also like points where you have to advertise, and the L&D account, liquidation and distribution account, has to sit for observation. You've got to advertise that there's creditors. Then there's another stage where you have to publicize that again, and there's a waiting period. And so the whole process is cumbersome. I'm very sure that some big banks have got big department. I've got departments that handle deceased estates. The advantage is that they are professional, they're not emotionally involved. The disadvantage is they are professional and then unemotionally and they're not involved emotionally. But it does also mean that you've got recourse your loved ones who have survived and who might need to be taken care of have got somewhere to go to say, hey, look, the banks do the wills for free if it's going to be held with them, if they're appointed as the executor. But we also have a wills week, and every single attorney does, well, not every single attorney, many attorneys do free wills in that week where there's no restriction on the executor. The bank also has knowledge of your accounts, of your banking, of your creditors, they have already got good knowledge. The difference is that, so it depends on what your personal situation is. I mean, if you've got a business that needs to have somebody put in as an interim curator while they appoint directors, and it's not a family business per se, it's not something that's, over generations, it's just you started it, it's wildly successful, your wife knows nothing about it, you might not want your wife to be the executor. Also, it's quite a burden on the executor who's got to make decisions about difficult things sometimes. So you might not wish to burden the person. You can also make an executor an accountant or a an attorney. And often you'd point an attorney's firm, you're dealing with one particular attorney, and then you say, okay, I want this attorney firm to be the executor. So if your fellow dies or whatever that's dealing with you, then somebody else in the firm will carry on, will carry on with it. But that is really personal to what your life is like and what your setup is like. If you've got, three wives or three ex-wives and six children and, 20 grandchildren, you might want somebody independent to do it. Does it contain, does your will, do you have trusts? Do you have, businesses? So it depends on the complexity of it, of who you're going to choose for the executor. And normally the choice is, who do you trust? Who do you trust to do the work and to make rational decisions, and who's not going to steal your money? Okay, those are the three things you're looking at. Some people don't have friends that fit that bill. So then I would say there's nothing wrong with going to a bank because they actually scour the death notices.
Yeah, and they are independent.
Yeah.
And they are, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
That's my view.
All right. So let's carry on. A will can exclude, include heirs, which are family members or not family members, and how, under what circumstances can someone challenge a will?
Okay, so you've got the freedom to do anything which belongs, or to do anything with your own possessions, right? So if you are married, are you married in community of property? Are you married out of community of property? Are you married out of community with accrual? That's your first step. Because what is in this bundle if you're married in community of property? Half of it's your wife's. You cannot give away her half. So you cannot say, the only asset in my estate is the 6 million rand house and I'm leaving it to my girlfriend.
Yeah.
Because your wife is. Owns half of your estate. So unless your estate has got another 6 million sitting there that is hers, or she's already got another 6 million rand house, you can't give that away. Do you understand what I'm saying? Half of that
Yes.
belongs to her. If it's accrual, that accrual calculation has to be made before anyone can inherit. So you can't leave an asset to somebody that isn't yours, basically. That's the first thing. The second thing aspect of it is you. Your duty to support your children and to provide maintenance for your children goes beyond your death. So your estate has to also provide maintenance to your children, if they need maintenance and they're still children under the age of 18. And that duty could extend to more older than that, but varsity. Then you also have a duty to support your spouse. So there's a surviving spouse, the act of supporting. Maintenance for Surviving Spouse Act. And so if you are married and you might be married out of community or property with no accrual, so it's all yours, and you married to somebody and you want to leave it to your girlfriend, that's absolutely fine. But your spouse has got a claim against your estate for her maintenance as well. And so before that girlfriend can take anything, the spouse has to make a claim.
Okay, so that I understand.
That typically, I must just stop interrupting. I'm using the example of how, interrupting myself here. They use the example of a house, but generally it is life insurance policies or, you know, death benefits on retirement annuities or something like that. That's normally where it comes in. So as part of the process when you're doing this, the admin after a death, is you actually have to say before a policy can be paid out, you there has to be proof to that company that there are no dependents with children or spouse. It used to be that they'd pay out, and you know, and then there was a claim, and you know, they'd try and claw back from the person who got the money, because in the case of a policy, you can name your beneficiary. So I can name my boyfriend, and in my you know, the death benefits on my retirement annuity or my life insurance policy, and my husband is not named there at all. It never goes into the estate. It only goes to that person directly, and yet it's got to be checked first. Does my husband need maintenance? Okay. And then they'll pay out to the nominated beneficiary. And if there's no nominated beneficiary, it just goes into the estate.
My understanding is that life insurance policies pay out quite quickly, because they are, unless otherwise stated somewhere, it is not part of the estate.
Correct. So it's not part of the estate, it pays out quite quickly. If there's a nominated beneficiary on that policy. And that also you can change very easily. So that's quite a nice way to make sure your family will keep going immediately after your death, because it can be as little as like 10 days, you know, that they can get the payment, depending on obviously the circumstances. But if you're the nominated beneficiary and there doesn't seem to be any fraud and there's no other claims of any other person, you can get paid out immediately. I must tell you something interesting I discovered when my own father was ill. He had a life policy, and he got a terminal illness, and then wasn't able to work, obviously, in that last year or so. And he was able to pay that. I was able to get that paid out early, so we used it for him. And his care and his expenses and everything, and that last little while of his life. And it just, we needed to do medical reports, and he needed to agree that he wanted to do it. I didn't know about that, and I have subsequently discovered that it's not common knowledge. And that's a very useful one. If someone is ill and is going to die, you can start getting those things in place already.
Now, that's interesting. You talked about a life insurance policy that paid out before he died.
Yep, because he had he had cancer, and he had once the doctor said he has no prospects of surviving it. I can't remember. The doctor had said it was going to be 3 months or 6 months or something. I can't remember how long that was, but because of that, because there was a medical report saying that he had this and he would not, his life expectancy was less than a year, and they paid out already at that point.
Okay, because obviously he's not going to be able to keep up the monthly payments.
Well, he may have been able to, I mean, some people may be able to do that, but that wasn't the point. The point was to provide for him, and so that he could control the reason that he had the life policy, he could control anyway. So he paid off all his debts. He paid back the loans with that money, and he was able to sort all of that out before he died, which I thought was very nice, a nice benefit. as the executor.
Okay. Let's talk. I don't know whether there's more to say about wills, because I'm sure there are.
Yeah, there's quite a lot to say about wills. You were asking me also about how can they be challenged. Can I go back to that quickly?
Yes.
Okay, so besides the formalities and that I've already spoken about, one of the things people often say is it's not his signature, and that's where the witnesses come in, right? The other thing they say is the person who made this will wasn't of sound mind at the time that they made it. And then the real duress, the or coercion. So sometimes somebody will change their will because someone has looked after them, has cared for them. The family's been nowhere around, and the neighbor became the carer and ended up like moving in to look after the person who's ill or old or whatever. They change their will, and the family says, "Hey, no ways. We got to inherit. Who's the stranger?" Meantime, they've been the stranger for 5 years, and this is the person who's been caring for him. And then it would have to go to court and a trial, and on what basis it was is being challenged. And they'll look for anything like the person wasn't of sound mind, or this carer had so much power that if she withdrew her care, then he was coerced into doing it, because you've got to do it of sound mind and your own free will. And so those are two areas that you can challenge a will on. Then there's also interpretation of the will that's really problematic often, where a phrase is ambiguous, or this is what it meant, or so recently I was asked for an opinion on a very, very old will, and it was the wording, I wish I could recall the exact wording, but what it became obvious is that the person had intended for his sons to inherit everything, but he wanted the woman that he had lived with for 30 something years to be cared for till her death, and then they would inherit only what was left, which included a movable property, a home that he owned. But the wording of it was such that it actually even never got to court, because the person who was the executor said that has no meaning, that must go to the remaining living sons. I was asked for opinion on whether it was worth challenging that interpretation of the will. But in that particular case, there was insufficient funds. The person challenging was not necessary of a sound mind, and I don't know that a power of attorney to an attorney would have been would hold up anyway, because she was living in this house, flat or in a complex or something, because she had to pay levies and she couldn't pay the levies. She had no money, so she couldn't actually stay there. And as soon as she sold it, then she lost that benefit, because that's what was the will intended for her to have, that property. So the sons would have had to agree to it being sold, and then that money used for her care, and then they would only get what was at the end. So that was a bit of a catch-22. I don't know what happened. I just gave an opinion. So that's another way, just interpretation. And the person who wants to challenge it, are they also of sound mind? And can they give an attorney instructions properly?
Well, okay. It makes me think of a situation where someone like that, living with a person for an N number of years, should really put pressure on the other person to say, "Hey, make a proper will, because otherwise I'm going to be destitute."
Yes, and sometimes you think you've got a proper will, and then the words are just bad. And that's why if you asked me, if you asked me about who whether a bank should be the executor, and I don't have any strong feelings about that, but when it comes to the writing of the will, I really recommend that an attorney who deals with deceased estates draws up your will for you. Really cannot stress how important that is. Somebody who's got experience in dealing with deceased estates who will then have seen what mistakes were made in wills, because there are, there's different levels of attorneys, and you're not going to be there to sort out the problem when that will comes into effect. So who you choose to write up your will is enormously important, almost more important than the executor.
Okay, it makes sense. Okay, we can move on to interstate. Is that the right pronunciation?
Yeah, I think so. Sounds fun.
Okay.
Sounds fun.
Because that's a much more complex scenario, is someone who dies without a will. Because I know that there are rules about who's your family, who is not your family. How distant is the family, and where does it begin and end? In other words, are nephews and nieces included, your mother, your father, your biological children, your stepchildren, your wife, etc. All each have a different percentage claim on the will.
Sort of, yes. Okay. So the complexity of this is going to depend on the complexity of your family. But okay, so this is of interest to me, but the Interstate Succession Act, there was a judgment, it's called the Behe judgment, BHE judgment, and this was now for people who are living, it was the customary law, and only men could inherit and women couldn't inherit. Now, I'm sure that we had this in Europe 200, 300 years ago, and I know that, land goes to the oldest man, and so it did away with that in South Africa, the Behe judgment, and then the Interstate Succession Act was, is the reflection of basically what happened in that judgment, which was quite exciting. Okay, so no longer do you have to be a man to inherit, and you don't have to be the eldest son of the main wife to inherit. Okay, so this applies through ever. So it says that basically, if you have a wife but no descendants, your wife inherits. Finish clause. If you have a descendant, so a child of yours that was born to you, not necessarily of the marriage or whatever, but a child, but you don't, and you don't have a spouse, then the dependent inherits it, or the descendant, the child or children inherit it, and it gets divided equally between the children. Okay, if there's more than one. And they're your children. That it doesn't specify at this point whether those children are of a marriage or not of a marriage. They're just who are your children, excluding sperm bank donations. Okay, so if you then have a wife and a child, then or children, then the total value of the estate is divided between them equally. So if you've got one wife and four children, you divide whatever the value of the estate is by five. The little kink that comes in there is that the wife gets a amount that is legislated by the government, and will be updated every now and again. It is currently 250,000 rand. So before you do the divide by five, if there's, depending on the value of the estate, okay, the wife is going to get either the divide by five or the 250,000 as legislated, depending which is more. Obviously, if the entire estate is only 200,000 rand, then she gets the 200,000 rand, and the children get nothing. but they still have to be supported, so there's a claim through that way. But the dividing of a estate is the wife gets 250k or a child's share, whichever is greater, and the number of children is, and plus the wife, is a child's share.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, the sad part of this is that, let's say the main asset is a house.
Mm.
It has to be sold in order to pay out all the heirs.
Yes. In a general principle, yes. If their main asset is a house, and you've got a wife and four kids, to go back to that same scenario, and the house is the only asset in the estate, what it doesn't have to be sold for it to be given immediately. They can agree, and it can be the master's office. The master of the High Court is the person who oversees wills and is interstate. So any deceased estate, plus trusts, plus curators, but that they oversee all of this. Okay, so if the only asset is a house, and the surviving spouse is able to take care of the expenses of the house, and the children are young, right, and they need a place to stay, there's absolutely no point in selling that house then and trying to buy another house with each of it. She can then say to the master, I want to keep this house, and when the children are all adults, then we pay out their portion, or I will pay out a portion. But you get a valuation of the house at the time, less obviously all the debts of the estate, and then that is the portion. Then that estate just keeps rolling on until the children either say, okay, now we want to sell because we're all co-owners. And then it gets recorded that they are co-owners of that property. So the deeds office will record that this property is held by five people, the wife and the four okay. kids. So there's other ways of doing it, is what I'm trying to say.
Okay, so it doesn't have to be sold. Obviously, if the children are underage, that makes sense. If the children have left home, and they can claim, hey, I want my cash.
So obviously this is presuming that the asset in the, there's no debts in that deceased estate. So if the house is the only asset and there's no debts that have to be paid, like, you know, personal loans or outstanding, if the estate can handle the debts, then the house doesn't have to be sold. If the estate cannot, then it has to be liquidated. The house has to be liquidated to pay the estate's debts. But that does not include the children. If the estate is paying, it's got to provide for the children, and the biggest expense is going to be somewhere for them to live, then we use some logic, you know?
Okay. Can there be more complexities? Can there be, grandchildren?
Okay. So this layer that we're talking about is spouse and children, right?
Yeah.
And if one of those children has already passed away and has children, then they will get their children. So in other words, the grandchildren will inherit that child's portion, according to who would have inherited that deceased child's portion. But that is normally if the child was alive when you died and then died off before the estate was wrapped up.
Okay. Parents of the person who's passed?
So if you have no wife and no child, then your parents will inherit. That's the next way up. And then if your parents don't exist, so if I've got no wife, no children, my mom and dad will inherit. Okay, if my mom and dad are already dead, then they say, okay, then the children of my mom and dad, so my mom and dad together will inherit, or if one of my parents have got other children as well, then it's so the first thing is the descendants of the deceased mother related to the deceased through only her, as well as the father. Okay, so it's where you've got same parents, the kids have got same parents, or if there's a deceased parents related to one or the other can also inherit, and then in equal shares, and then if they and their children can inherit in equal shares. So it goes up first to your parents, then it goes to your siblings, and then it looks at, and when we're not talking about step siblings in here, but it can be half siblings. So if there's no actual siblings, then we start looking for half siblings. And if there's no half sibling, before we look at half siblings, we look at siblings' children, and then we go to half siblings.
Okay. I remember there used to be sort of a diagram that said you are separated from your parents by one leg. You are separated from your sibling by two legs. It's one up to the parents and then one down to the sibling.
There are still diagrams like that. We use they also like who you're allowed to marry. You're not allowed to marry a first cousin, but you can marry a second cousin.
What a pity.
So this is similar, and it's all controlled by the master. So maybe I should just mention that whether when somebody dies, the person who you don't have to be the executor, you don't have to be in the will or anything, but there's a duty to report. So if you're the person who's the main person in the life, you can report it. The example I was giving earlier of the caretaker can report it, but you have to report to the master. So if the duty was on you because you were involved in this person's life, or you're a child or a parent or something, you have to report that estate to the master. And I think it's 10 days or 14 days. There doesn't seem to be any repercussion for not reporting it quickly, because sometimes these things are really difficult. But you cannot start giving things away. You cannot distribute, you cannot use the deceased money or anything until the master has said it's okay. So when you're looking at the will and an executor is only appointed if it's in the will or the estate is worth more than 250,000, without a will. Otherwise, if it's interstate and the amount is less than 250,000, then an administrator is appointed. And we have a lot of litigation in this area, is where the person dies interstate, and the master appoints an executor or an administrator, and they think that they now mean that they get to decide who gets the money, and they spend it. So that is a point that often happens. So some people will, the under 250,000 estates, they get the letter of that they've been appointed as the administrator of the deceased estate in the interstate, and they think that now they can go take the house and I can have talking about a modest home, and I can now get his pension or whatever. They can't. Their job is just to administer it according to the law, and that we get a lot of complexities on that in law. The executor's role is also very, very highly regulated. So when you have die interstate, and your estate is worth more than 250,000, then you report the death, and then you nominate a executor, And hopefully with approval of the family members and that. And the master makes that decision of who's going to be appointed as the executor. And then all the rules that apply, whether you've got a will or not, apply to this. Just how the estate is distributed is different in a will and an intestate. So, but the controls are exactly the same. So if you get a attorney appointed as an executor in an intestate matter, or it doesn't have to be attorney, somebody else, they will have to provide security to the master. And that's normally in the form of some sort of insurance policy. And you'll often find in a will a clause waiving security. So the person appointed in the as an executor doesn't have to provide that security. The cost of that security is normally borne by the estate, but you have to have it. Because the master controls what's happening on this deceased estate. There's you open a separate bank account for the deceased estate. And officially, all money that you spend, other than mere maintenance of the children and the family, is got to be first okayed by the master.
I've got a story to tell you.
Tell.
When I was very, very young, in fact, my first job was with a bank. And my job, eventually, I had a job of clearing bank accounts of deceased people. And they were typically a few thousand rand, could be 10, 20, 30,000 rand. Mm-hmm. And I had to find the executor and alert him about this money and then get him to reopen the estate and distribute the money. And they had zero interest in doing that.
Yeah.
The opportunity for fraud on my part was huge because I knew this money existed. I knew that the executor had no interest in the money because to reopen the estate was just too big a job just to distribute this few thousand rand. But that's just a side story. One of my colleagues got arrested for doing exactly that on the savings account side.
Sure. Okay, so you know that file that I spoke about earlier, the in case of fire file, where your will should be, there should be a list of all your bank accounts, all your policies, all your like garden service, everything written down with account number and everything. But what has changed? I just want to also say, on the there are millions and millions of rands of unclaimed RAs, retirement annuities, and things that had a death benefit, or unclaimed pension funds that also have a death benefit, and there's so much there.
It's huge.
So what are and part of the process I spoke about was having to advertise. You say this person with this ID living at this address died, and it has to be in the Government Gazette. I don't know what the requirements are for local papers. I think that might I don't know if it is every time, but there are some requirements for local advertising in the area that they lived in as well. But the Government Gazette, so it used to be that banks or whatever would actually employ people to look through that to see if those ID numbers matched with anyone holding an account. But now what we can do is, if your executor is an attorney, they are able to contact all the big players like Sanlam and whatever. Does this person with this ID have any policies with you? Does this person, as soon as they've got that appointment as an executor from the master's office, as soon as you got that letter, you can start. And then you can also send out to all the banks and say, please check for this ID number. And they do that. So I don't know if that is something that happened after, whether it's after you were working in the bank many moons ago, or whether it's something that where attorneys haven't done a proper job, or the person or the ID number was perhaps you know, mistakenly written or something like that. But that's how they find these policies and things. Yeah.
No, so I'm talking about it. I'm talking about a time when computers weren't that sophisticated.
In the olden days. So can we just put chalk that up to, if you're trying to choose an executor, another reason to have an executor who's an attorney. But I must add that any executor, and here in KZN, the master's office is not interested in dealing with anyone who's not an attorney. So I walked in as an advocate, and they said, give a power of attorney to an attorney. And so that the executor still gets to make the decisions, but the attorney does all the work. Problem is about payment of fees. The executor then is entitled, the attorney doing the role, even though they're not the executor, entitled to the fees. You can negotiate with an attorney and say, I will pay you per hour, rather than the fees, which at the moment are, it's 3.5% of the gross value of the estate, plus 6% of any income earned in the time that it took to from when the person was appointed as the executor, any income generated in that time. If it's below 250,000 and you ask to be the executor, you can charge 15%.
It sounds terrible, but it also sounds fair to me.
Yeah, so what happens is what do they say? Swings and roundabouts. So some estates, they score massively, and others are more modest estates, and they don't even cover the costs of the actual doing the work, you know, the normal rates or whatever. So some attorneys obviously don't want to do per hour, but if the executor, even if they appoint, I mean, the executor is entitled to that fee, but normally what happens when it's a friend or whatever, you don't take your fee that you're entitled to anyway, and it gets paid to the attorney, who the attorney's allowed to take that as the executor, because they're acting, you've given them the power of attorney.
Okay, I'm going to try and keep... just simplify things a little. So, if there's such a thing as a normal family, but let's assume there is, a normal family in my book would be a husband and wife and a couple of children.
2.5 children would be average, yes. Okay, let's go 2 children.
All right, go 2 children. We've got a husband, a wife, and 2 children. He dies interstate, the estate gets divided in 3, and that's the end of the story.
No.
Right?
What are they married as?
Okay. In community of property, that means she gets half.
Half outright.
And the balance gets divided in 3.
Correct. Okay. And then we've got to take into consideration, is that child shared less than the 250,000? That's the current limit for the spouse's share. Okay. So you got to, if that divide by 3 is more than 250,000, then she just gets a child share. Right.
All right. Let's say the kids are his, but not hers.
Yep. Same applies.
Same applies. Okay. And that's the simple version. You've covered quite a lot of exceptions to that. And that is when the kids are hers and not his.
Your stepchildren don't inherit unless you've done a will.
Okay.
Your stepchild being the child of your spouse, a half sibling. So you could die with 2 children. One is of this woman, one is of that woman. They're both children. So one from your first wife, one from your second wife. They're both your children. They get a child's share. Okay. Irrespective. Okay, can we just throw that little spanner in the works, because this is law, of course, there's a spanner. That estate, the wife gets her half share, but there's also surviving spouse claim, maintenance of children claim, possible before the division. Okay, so and then obviously we've got those policies that could be outside of the actual estate as well. So if the husband had a policy that he made his wife the beneficiary, she gets her half of the joint estate, she gets the policy without it being considered as half of the estate, and she gets her child's share, her child's portion.
Okay, this This is a much bigger subject than a one-hour podcast, but
and we're not doing hours; we're doing shorter than hours. Can I make another little spanner in the works there?
Yes.
Adopted children.
Yeah. Oh, but adopted children are children, aren't they?
Absolutely. But if you gave your child up for adoption, and you put them, and you think they're going to just inherit, if you interstate, they're not, because that legal relationship is broken. Your child is no longer yours because somebody else adopted them. First thing. Second thing, if you do a will and you think you're very clever, I want all five of my children to inherit, and four of your children were adopted by somebody else, one child is going to inherit. There's no, you can use the word plural, but there's only one child that is still yours. Then that child will inherit.
That is if you put in your will my children. Now, if you name your children?
No, if you name them, you're fine. You say, I want child A, B, C, D, and E, F, G, and then other child, and you name them, and you put their ID numbers. It doesn't matter that the relationship is broken because that there's no legal parent relationship, because you've got freedom of testations. You can give your money to whoever you want. You don't have to have a relationship with them. But just to be clear on that, you can't say my children and think that it includes the children that you've no longer have. You know, they have been adopted by somebody else. Because stepfathers often do the adopting, and the estranged father, whatever, you know, he's not dead. He's somewhere in the, you know, been a druggie for 5 years and then starts a business or gets back onto his feet, and his children have been adopted in the meantime, obviously with consent, or the consent has been waived by the court because he's abandoned them or hurt them, and he gets his life together, and part of his penance he feels is, I want my children to inherit everything I have, and then he writes, my children, they ain't getting anything because they're not his children. He'll have to name them.
Okay, what more?
We spoke about like the content of the will a little bit and what could be challenged and things like that. So the biggest problem that we discover is ambiguity. And one of the things that has in three of my matters has come up is where the person signing the will hasn't distinguished between either a trust or a business, or, you know, this farm is actually owned by this trust. It's not owned by him, but he treats it as his farm. Or the house is actually owned by a business, by a PTY or a CC. Then that makes that his wish that his son inherits his house, but his house is owned by a close corporation. He's not going to get that. And the son's not going to get it because it's not his. It's a close corporation's. The son, at best, can get the shares in this close corporation that owns the house. So that's, you have to be very careful of legal entities when you're making wills. So you would then say, you wouldn't say my son gets the house. You say my son gets the shares of the CC that owns that house, or any subsequent properties that CC might own. Otherwise, it's invalid, you know, because you say that son gets that house that's through that CC, and then you die. But in the meantime, the CC sold that house and bought two others. He doesn't get that.
Okay.
So that was the one thing. The other thing that is, what tools can you use in your will to protect and to provide for? So one of the tools is a usufruct, and the other thing is trusts. Okay, so you can create, for example, you know, you're in your 60s, you and your wife are living in your home that you've always had, and you want your kids to inherit it one day, you married out of community or property, all of those things, but you want your wife to have somewhere to live for the rest, for as long as she wants to. You can, in your will, give the property to your children, subject to her having the right to continue living in that property.
Yeah, that's an important thing.
Yeah, and you can also make provision, because she gets the, she has the obligations much similar to what someone would have if they were renting, and but she also gets the benefits of the fruits of it. So she can even rent out a room, and she'll get that rent. But you can also provide that the estate must hold the money to provide for electricity or maintenance, or you can do that. So,
Yeah.
but in that usufruct, so and it can be usufruct for a lifetime. It can be a usufruct for a lifetime of your child. That sometimes we see that on farms, where there's the family, there's the farm's held in trust, but there's six family houses or something like that. They get usufructs registered against that. The other thing that is useful is the formation of trusts in your will. You don't have to have a will while you don't have to have a trust while you're alive, but you can create one in your will, and have separately to your executors. You can have trustees, so you put a certain amount of your money in a trust, and you can even put all of your money in a trust if you've got a minor child or minor children. And so you say, I want all the money to go into a trust. The trust must be administered by so and so and so and so. So it's joint decision making, and it goes to the also under the watchful eye of the master, and that trust monies be used for education or travel or whatever. And when the children reach the age of 25 or are self-sufficient or whatever, then that money goes back into the state for distribution, or that's when the children can inherit it. That way you haven't got children who are 10 years old inheriting 25 million rand, and with all the risks associated with that, you can have trustees managing it, for the benefit of those children, and they can invest it and all of those things that you might envisage happening. You give them enough powers. In your will, you state what the trust's powers and the trustee's powers will be, and then that trust is registered, after the death, and it gets managed like a trust. And what happens if you don't? What happens if you don't provide? I've said that there's a maintenance of children and thing. If there's an inheritance of a child and there's no protections or there's no parent, sometimes even if they just think the other parent is dicey, the master can decide that that money must go, any money for the benefit of children, for their maintenance or inheritance, must go into the guardian's fund. And it sits there, and then you write to the master's office on the guardian fund and say, I now need 2,000 rand for school fees. I now need this. And it sits in that guardian's fund and is distributed. It's a painful process, but it is a way of ensuring that nobody else gets their hands on it.
I've got two stories to tell, but I'll let you finish, and then I'll get to my two stories.
Nope, I think that's all. I wanted to mention the forming a trust, and I wanted to mention the Guardian Fund. If you don't do something to protect it, your money could land up there, and then also the use of usufructs.
Okay, let me
Tell me
tell you
else.
my story.
Tell me, tell me.
Tell me, you know, I used to be a wine farmer.
I do recall.
Okay, now. I lived in Tilbach and knew a lot of farmers. And one of the things that struck me was that it was almost tradition, not law, but tradition, that farmers would leave the entire farm to the oldest child. And there's a simple reason for that. Dividing that farm up among three or four or five children was just not practical, because none of them can make you, the farm is not big enough to support five families. The farm is big enough to support one family, and that would typically become the oldest sibling. And the others would be sent to university and say, hey, you're on your own, you're going to make your own life, but the farm is going to go to the oldest and mostly boy. And that was my one story. Okay. The other one is in studying winemaking, I learned a lot about laws in other countries, and particularly France, where there was a law that a farm had to be divided among all the children for generations upon generations. And the end result is that in France you have large vineyards, farms, where one row of vines would belong to one child or one person, and the next row of vines would belong to another one, and not the next row of vines would belong to another one. It is insane. No one can make money. No one can really really manage the whole setup.
Yeah, that's when it needs to go into a business, and a business runs it, and you just get your share of that 1/100th of a row or whatever, 1/100th of the business or something.
Yeah, but that law still exists today.
Mm.
It's crazy, and that explains why partly explains why most of the vineyards or the very famous farms, wines in France, belong to banks. Because eventually the banks would foreclose on these bankrupt people because they would all go bankrupt. And most of these, like Chateau Rothschild and farms like that, belong to banks.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I must just tell you something about your Tulbagh experience with the oldest son inheriting. So in South Africa, you may not divide a farm without the approval of the Minister of Agriculture. So you can't leave a farm to three people and to divide it in South Africa without the minister first approving that, a subdivision. And that is why also so many farmers have their farms are in a trust. And then the trust document sets up who, you know, these are going to be the beneficiaries of the profits of the farm, and the trust owns it. So the kids never own it. They are beneficiaries of the trust in perhaps equal share of the profits of that farm. But of course, if somebody is working it, then the trust must pay that person a salary, whereas other people are off at varsity or whatever, as you say. But if there's no profit, they can't share the profit of it because there's no profit.
Yeah.
So that would be a way of that would be a way of protecting it. So a lot of farmers also have their farms in trust, and then dividing a farm in South Africa, it takes a long time. Any agricultural land, you have to have approval, or for the redesignation of it. So where, you know, farms, you know, if the towns explode and grow and grow, and suddenly the sugarcane farmer says, "I'm really tired of looking at these flats," and the flat developers are saying, "I really want that sugarcane field to build some more flats." That has to be done through the minister as well.
Yeah. No, farms, it's out of this subject, but a farm needs to be able to have all the facilities in order to farm. In other words, it needs water, it needs enough grazing, it needs to be a profitable entity. In other words, it must be viable.
Yeah, what is the word that, what is the, it needs the big enough land to hold not only the number of, you know, you can't say, okay, well, in this one I can have 10 cows, and this piece of land, that farmer can have 100 cows, but how can you make your 10 cows profitable versus the 100 being more profitable, or the 1,000 being more profitable? I just can't think of that word right now.
It's just not a viable entity.
Yeah. So, I mean, like you can't, if you've got a small field, you can't hire or you can't buy a tractor. It doesn't to till that field. But if you've got a large field, you can buy a tractor, or you can hire a tractor. You know, it makes sense. The other one you've got to do by hand. So blah, blah, blah. But it's interesting how we spoke briefly about making a trust in your will, creating a trust. But what happens when there's an existing trust? You can't will anything about a trust. It all happens within the trust deed and within by the trustees, overseen also by the master.
Okay, we can leave it here.
Thanks so much, Hank.
I went off on a tangent in the end, but I thought there were
interesting
things.
Absolutely. I like your tangents. Okay. Bye, a donkey. Right. Thank you, Hank.
Okay. Have a good day.
Ciao.
Bye.
Okay, I've stopped. Yeah, same. Oh, no, I haven't stopped.